Hey everyone, my name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy. And back in 2010, I interviewed a guy who was a Mixergy fan who had a good idea for a business that was doing well, but wasn't going to do great. So he did the gutsy thing and he scrapped that idea and he started a new company. And I invited him to talk about how he did it and the guts involved with shutting down something that was doing okay to try to get something big. I see Jack, my interviewee, is smiling. He remembers it. And the new company was called SeatGeek. And we talked about how he was growing it, what happened. And man, in the years since then, I keep hearing SeatGeek's name mentioned in just about any conversation around sports and ticketing. And every time I hear their name, I go, I know that company. I know that guy. I remember them when. They just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And so now I've got the co-founder here to talk about what's happened since then and how big they've gotten and how they got this far. His name is Jack Gretzinger. He is the co-founder of SeatGeek. SeatGeek is a marketplace for live entertainment. You know, you open up the app and you see all the sports events and comedy shows in your city, and you get to see what tickets sell for, and you get to basically find the right price and the right seat in an easy to use application. I really like the way that they did it. And he also has something brand new that they didn't have or even didn't think about back when we first talked about SeatGeek. It's something called SeatGeek Open. It's a radically open approach to ticket sales by a venue. If I stumbled over that intro or that line, it's because it was given to me. And I actually think the description that Jack's going to give us is going to be way clearer, and you'll see how big his ambition is and how much impact he wants to have on the world of ticketing and events. This interview is sponsored by two companies that you probably know if you've listened to Mixergy. The first will help you close your sales. It's called Pipe Drive, and the second one will help you hire your next great developer, designer, or finance expert. It's called Top Tal. I'll tell you guys all about them later. First, Jack, welcome, man.
Thanks for having me.
Back then, 2010, your co-founder didn't tell me the revenue. I kept pushing him. I'm even looking at the transcript now. I pushed and pushed and pushed, and he didn't want to tell me. Do you have a sense of where you guys were at the time that I was talking to him?
I'd be lying if I said I knew with any specificity. It was probably quite small. We were probably selling at most a few thousand dollars tickets a day.
A few thousand a day. So you were in the hundreds of thousands a year.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Okay. Solid, but not nearly where you are today. What's the revenue like today?
These days we sell upwards of $1 to $2 million of tickets per day.
And then how much of that do you guys keep?
It varies a lot by the particular type of ticket, but on average it's over 10%.
Over 10. Do you have an annual revenue that you can share?
We don't share that, but you can sort of back into it based on that. Yeah.
Okay. And funny that you gave our producer the revenue, but on camera you'd rather not do it. Okay. I appreciate it. I respect it. I think we've got a good sense of where you guys are, and I feel that by respecting boundaries, however like artificial they might seem to outsiders, I get a much more open conversation.
Yeah.
What I remember about you and your co-founder is that you and Russ just had tons of ideas. In fact, he told me about a business that you launched and sold. The furniture business was another one where you rented furniture to college students on campus, and then you sold that company. I didn't know that before you met Russ, you also had something called Applied College Consulting. What was that?
Yeah, impressive. When I was in high school, I sort of just fooling around with the ideas on the internet. And it basically was a marketplace for linking up retired English school high school English teachers with kids who were applying for college. So if you wanted some help, you know, editing your college essay, we would kind of help you find an English school teacher who would help you edit it and make it better so that you'd have a better shot of getting into school.
Yeah, that's a great idea. I feel like that's the kind of idea that was maybe ahead of its time, because I don't know how open people were to making connections like that back then. How did it do?
It was a great learning experience. I think I made what at the time was probably a fun amount of money. In retrospect, was probably an unimpressive amount of money from it for a few years.
And what was it? Just,
you know, it's funny. I honestly don't remember exact. I think I was probably generating a few thousand bucks a month at most.
That's not bad.
But it was mostly just, you know, that for me, that was the first time I accepted a credit card online, which back then actually wasn't that easy to do. You know, dealt with customer service, just basic stuff that was pretty foundational and was a ton of fun.
Did you stick with school or did you drop out?
Stuck with school throughout, yeah. I pretty intentionally didn't do CS in school, did econ and math instead because I sort of knew that I was going to, I thought I would be doing this stuff for the rest of my life. So programmed throughout college, but I've always been a self-taught, you know, web engineer, never had a formal CS background.
Web engineer with a real entrepreneurial streak. I could just keep going and listing the companies you started, but and the ones that you were thinking of starting. It just goes on and on. And then what I'm looking at here on your LinkedIn profile is 2007, you go and work for Bain Consulting. Why?
Yeah, sometimes I ask myself that. You know, so I was at Bain for 7 or 8 months before Russ and I. Russ had a management consulting gig in Boston at the same time as me. And we both sort of conspired to leave our jobs the same week to go do a startup together. And we didn't know what we were going to do at the time. And I think, if I'm being honest, like both of us sort of did it a little bit as, you know, got caught up in the flow of recruiting in college and it seemed like a safe thing to do. And we probably regretted it pretty soon after we got there. I will say that I got really freaking good at Microsoft Excel and that skill has stuck with me.
You mean at Bain?
At Bain, yeah.
Okay.
I watched Excel for 7 months. and it was really worth the 7 month investment just for that alone. And I'm sure I got like some basic professional skills from it too. But, it was sort of a weird detour and a series of jobs that probably otherwise would have
been. I get it. I went to NYU as an undergrad. I studied business with people who all had these fantasies of starting companies. I remember a few months before graduation day, everybody was carrying tape recorders around with them because they were practicing interview skills into it, which was kind of a weird thing to do. And they were all going towards this the job track. And I thought maybe there's something wrong with me for wanting to go start my own thing. And it was easy to look around and say, that's the natural next step. I see why you would work there. You guys then spent a few months on the job, but constantly at coffee shops thinking up ideas. Do you remember some of the ideas that maybe you didn't pursue, but in retrospect were solid ideas?
You know, it's funny because we kept a list of stuff that we were fooling around with and Russ and I were looking back at that a few years ago, and I remember the one that stuck out was some description that you could sort of contort into being an early version of Uber that Russ had come up with. And I'm sure like a million people have thought of that, and it's also, you know, ideas are cheap, right? But I think we've always been interested in marketplaces and like, you know, how do you kind of bring people together online?
I see that. Why? Marketplaces are, it feels like some of the hardest businesses to create because you have to get both sides of the conversation to show up at the same time. And that's a tough thing to do.
Yeah. I love the fact that when you have marketplaces, you have a take rate. You have like a real, you know, monetization engine sort of deeply built in. Right. So, you know, the previous company we ran, was a detour from that. It was a learning experience for both of us where really had no business model at all.
Scrivenia.
Scrivenia, yeah.
The Yelp idea is we for would, writers.
Yelp for bloggers, recommendation engine for bloggers. Got really good traction, but we did it at a time when, you know, CPMs on the internet were falling off a cliff, and it was super demoralizing to see something actually go well and be like, shit, I have no idea how we're going to make money. Mm-hmm. So, you know, day we launched SeatGeek, we had revenue, and that's grown since then, and I love that about it. And I love that, you know, there's a real sort of business model intrinsically built into it.
I get that. And what you did to solve the chicken and the egg problem of marketplaces, you can't get one side without the other, and the other won't show up without the first side, right, is you guys scrape data online, right?
Yeah, we, you know, so, you know, SeatGeek pulls inventory from a lot of different ticket sites online. And the thing we did was we realized, okay, this inventory is already sitting online. We don't have to get people. So the other sites, other ticket marketplaces, get people to actively push inventory to you. We said, you know what, we're actually going to go out to these sites and we say, we'll do the work for you. We'll pull it onto SeatGeek. Just let us, you know, expose your APIs to us. We'll do the work. And that was a way to get a lot of rich inventory onto our site, without having to, you know, deal with that chicken and egg problem for many, many years. Flip side of that is the unit economics for us were crap for a long time.
Why?
Because it was effectively sort of an affiliate relationship, right? Where the transaction's occurring somewhere else, and we're just pulling the inventory, we're sourcing the sale, and then we're flipping the user to somewhere else where they transact. So as we matured as a company, we eventually had to bring the transaction onto SeatGeek so that we could own the user relationship, ultimately deliver a better experience. Because one thing we realized is that the transaction's not happening on your site or in your app, particularly in a mobile context, it's really hard to deliver just a world-class user experience. You know, we want, when someone buys a ticket in our app, we want it to be magically freaking good, where few taps, you bought what you wanted, the ticket just shows up right in your device and you can scan in. And if you're dealing with third-party checkout, third-party delivery, it's really hard to deliver that. So, you know, long story short, as we matured, we had to get away from that. But for just bootstrapping inventory early on, it was a really efficient way to solve that problem.
Before the interview started, I said, can I introduce SeatGeek as a search engine for tickets? And you didn't say no. I like the way you said it. You said, we actually prefer to be called a marketplace for live entertainment, but I understand now why you wouldn't want to be considered a search engine, because a search engine implies you come here to find it and then you go there to do what you came to search for. I see. In the beginning, the idea came from you guys looking at Microsoft buying Faircast, and what Faircast was known for was forecasting airline fares, so that if you wanted to go from San Francisco to New York and you weren't sure about what date you wanted or when you should buy the ticket, you can go there and they'll tell you, look, if you wait another week, it's going to be cheaper than if you do it today. I didn't realize at the time, Russell didn't tell me, that the reason you backed off of that idea and went towards that whole Yelp for Blogger thing is that you were worried about patent issues.
Yeah. Yeah, it sucked. We got some bad legal advice.
From whom?
Initially, I actually don't remember the lawyer's name, but it was basically an IP lawyer that I think in retrospect was just dead wrong.
I see, just a random IP lawyer that you were introduced to?
Yeah, I forget the relate. I think it was sort of a friend of a friend kind of thing. I guess it shows the value of paying a little bit more for lawyers. Got some bad advice, didn't want to mess around with, you know, infringing on Microsoft patents, so we held off for a while.
I see. And that's why you got diverted to a new business. Then you get into, what was the accelerator? Dreamit. Dreamit's not around anymore, that accelerator, right?
They are. They've changed their model. So they don't, they actually, they focus on a few verticals now, like healthcare.
I see. Okay. So you get in there, but the thing that they did for you is say, hey, forget it. No, you guys are worried about the wrong thing. There actually is not an issue with these, with the patents. And I think at the time, Russell didn't want to get into it because just in case there was an issue with patents, why bring it up and say, hey, there's no issue, right? And draw attention to yourself. So that's why you guys didn't continue with it. And that's why you got back into it. And that business then started to take off. I thought at the time it was brilliant to take something that worked for airlines and bring it into sports events and other ticketing. In retrospect, though, did it work out? Was that the magic that...
No. In fact, eventually we, I think the seed of what we were trying to do there was worth something. We were trying to basically bring data to bear and add transparency to a market that had very little. Forecast specifically, we learned most ticket buyers don't care about that much. It's just too complicated. So, you know, ultimately, if you're trying to go see Taylor Swift, it's not like you're trying to refinance your house. It's not that complicated of a purchase. You just want a great deal quickly and you want to move on in your life. And that's what SeatGeek delivers today. Whereas the sort of forecasting was made it a more complicated purchase than it had to be. And that's the feedback we got from a lot of users.
Did you know that? How did users communicate to you that this thing that you thought you were going to build your business on, that when you heard you couldn't do, you gave up on the business on because it was so important to you, that thing we don't like? How did they communicate it to you in a way that you understood and said, fine?
So it was, you know, obvious answer from talking to people. But the interesting thing is, when you talk to some people, they actually loved it. So there's certainly a power user that would be like, hell yeah, I love this. This is like what I've been waiting for my whole life. The realization that took more time was that, yeah, there were power users that were into it, but most people weren't. And we were not quick enough to catch on to that. We basically slowly realized that the features on our site that were getting more and more use were not what we were spending the most time on. It would be sort of more e-commerce purchasing stuff. So we would be talking to the users that we thought were, you know, our core, and they would say, this is great stuff. But in fact, that was sort of a sliver of the market.
So it was looking at your data to see what people were using that helped you understand that?
Yeah, exactly. And I think just broadening our minds about, you know, the potential of what we could build. So, you know, the broad thesis that we started with was that ticketing was and still is a very opaque industry, that it's a very complicated purchase. It's not like buying, you know, a MacBook where there's a pretty well-established price and you sort of know what you're going to pay and it is what it is. Ticketing inventory is entirely unique and it's always moving around and there's fees and you don't know what the fees are. We wanted to bring transparency and use data to bring transparency. And we thought that forecasting would be a good first way to do that. And the product today still uses a lot of data to try to add transparency. So that sort of still lives on. It's just the particular forecasting component, I think, was too complicated for people.
Can you tell me more about how you understood that? I'll tell you why. I see this as an issue a lot with entrepreneurs who I've interviewed. They have something in mind. The customer base, for the most part, rejects it, but some people do like it. They stick with it because people are giving them positive feedback, but it takes them a long time to realize that is not the feedback they should be listening to. Yeah. Was there a process where you expanded your view and went bigger? Was there something that led you to give up on this piece of the business that was so critical for a long time?
I wish there was a magic moment where we had this sort of brilliant realization. I would say it was more of a gradual realization where, you know, sort of just to simplify it, imagine there was two tracks of development. One was forecasting related development and one was e-commerce development. And initially we were sort of all in forecasting and e-commerce stuff was like this thing we threw in because you have to monetize it somehow. And the sort of ROI we saw in terms of usage on that second part was always weirdly high. So we figured, all right, we'll spend a little bit more on that. And then as we invested more time on that, the ROI kept going up and we kept going down on forecasting. And eventually we realized just from seeing user behavior that shit, you know, we should go talk to these people, see why they like it so much. So spent more time with those users, understood what was resonating, and eventually realized that the opportunity and the, you know, scope of the product was much bigger than we'd been thinking.
What was your process for spending more time with the users? Did you bring them into the office, fly out to see them, call them?
I like just doing that. It's just video chats.
You just call. You just find somebody who is a customer and you personally would chat with them?
Yeah, just usually email them, which sometimes creeps people out, but usually doesn't. Email them, say, you know, hey, founder, willing to chat. Often they'll say yes, and then just hop on at the time, just Skype and get their thoughts.
Were there some questions that worked especially well for you? I remember Emmett Shear of Twitch had a list of questions that worked really powerfully for him. Were there any that were especially useful for you?
The thing that I love doing is just screen sharing with them and watching them use it and asking them why they're making the choices that they're making.
I see. So as they're buying, you're watching them and was there anything that you discovered from that was especially shocking or interesting?
You always want to, you know, you spend so much time on an interface and you have this idea of how people are supposed to use it and they invariably miss what you think, although you're an idiot, I'm you in this case,
yeah,
are just glaringly obvious elements of the interface. And you just want to freaking scream at them for what the hell are you thinking? But I would always struggle to keep my mouth shut and not do that. And over time, the first time that happens, I would always chalk it up to just being an anomaly, right? Oh, that person's an idiot. They just don't get it. And then it happens like five or six more times and you start to realize that you're the idiot, not them. And you kind of reevaluate your assumptions.
What's one thing that you remember, if any, that you thought was great, but nobody used it and you just had to bite your tongue as you watch them not use it?
So we have a feature on SeatGeek called Deal Score that, basic idea is that it ranks bang for your buck. So, rather than just sorting tickets by price, we sort by what's the best deal. And at first, we were very bad at communicating basically what that was because it's a little bit of a subtle concept that we kind of made up. So we've gotten better at messaging what it is so that users understand it. But at first, we did a very poor job and users would struggle with it. And I would want to kind of like go on a 5-minute explanation with them and try to, you know, explain it to them with my voice, but instead you really had to sort of hold my tongue and watch them try to figure it out using the interface alone.
I see, because I don't actually see prices here by listed from least expensive to most expensive, and that's why.
You can sort, there's in the sort, I don't know if you're in the app or...
Yes, I'm in the app, and yes, I know I could sort by hitting the gear. And I love when I hit the sort, it doesn't just bring up the filter, it actually pushes the screen I'm looking at in an angled way down. It's like really nice touches to the user experience that make it fun to use the app. I see. And so that's the thing that you had to figure out. How do I explain it? How do I show enough that it doesn't look like we've made a mistake?
Yep.
Right. And then also, what is HackMonk? Sorry?
How do you get that math to be accurate enough that people actually trust it? It's the sort of thing where if you slip up now and then, they totally lose faith in, you know, what you're telling them.
It's like HipMunk, what do they call it? The pain score or something there, right?
Agony. Yeah, very similar to that.
Right, because if you have to pay a few more dollars, but you don't have three stops on the way to New York from Washington, D.C., it's worth paying the extra money. You know, I mentioned at the top of the interview that my two sponsors, did you happen to know of Pipedrive, one of the two sponsors I mentioned? I got to tell you about them. I use Pipedrive to keep track of every part of this interview. Like the whole sequence. Back when it was me and Russ, I'm looking at this email from 2010. I sent it, Rohit Jain sent him an email saying, hey, you should connect with Andrew and do an interview. His email back to me was, yeah, Andrew, I watch your interviews. I'd love to do it. My email back to him was, here's a link. Let's go do it. That was it.
Cool.
Right? Back then, I didn't have that many interviews. Today, it's not just that I have more interviews, but also there are more people in charge of the process. As you know, we got a producer who does a pre-interview, someone who makes sure that, you know, that you're legitimately who you are, that there's research that says, yes, your business is big. So on. To keep track of it all, we use Pipedrive. Every step of the booking process has its own column. Every time there's a potential guest who suggests it, we create a card for them and we put them in column number one, which is suggest a guest. Then someone else says, let me go research and see if this guest should be on Mixergy. They research them, they move them to card number two. Yeah, I see you're nodding, you get it, right? Intuitively, it all makes sense, all the way up to the last column, which is what's going to happen 5 minutes after I finish this interview, which is I'm done. And then it fires off an email to the editor saying, Andrew's done, go edit it. Well, that's what helped us not just keep track of our guests. And now our guests say, I love the process. Every part of it made me feel like you guys knew where I was and you cared for me. But it also allowed me to have more guests on, keep track of the process internally, have more people be a part of it so I don't have to do it all. And the reason I'm bringing this up is most people are not booking interviews. I know you're not, Jack, booking interviews. But people who are listening to me are closing sales. And it can be a tough process. One of the things I suggest is just go create an account on Pipedrive, create your collection of columns with each step of your sales process and watch as Pipedrive nurtures you through each part of the sale process and pushes you to sell and gives you stats so that if you think you call a lot of people, but two of them only returned your calls, it says, hey, you know what? Actually, you only reached out to five people. Get on it, little – I was going to say pussy, but I don't think they want me to say that in the ad. So I'll say pussy. Get on it, even though they don't want me to. What are they going to do, cancel for that? It's true. It really needs to push you and say, stop being a wuss. Get on it and make the number of sales calls and the number of emails that you need. And more importantly, as you grow, it grows with your sales team so that we can all coordinate, so that you're not finding every potential guest. Someone else does. And then anyway, does a lot of things. I can't say enough about it. All I can do is tell you the best thing to do is go check them out. And because they're a sponsor, they're giving us free time on Pipedrive. All you have to do is go to pipedrive.com/Mixergy. Pipedrive.com/Mixergy. They'll give you a bunch of free time to use it, and you'll see that it'll help you close sales. All right. Now, frankly, you guys at SeatGeek don't need it. The reason you don't need it is because your sales happen within the app, right? If you're calling people, if you're – maybe this guy Nate needs it. Who's Nate Ratner?
He's on our communications team.
So one of the things that you guys have always done a freaking killer job with is PR. Right from the start, you hired a PR company. You said, we have all this data. We're going to use it to create blog posts and to tell our story and to help other reporters tell the story of what's going on. Right? That helped you grow. What else helped you as you got going, build up your user base?
Another thing that, you know, people don't talk about as much anymore, but it's been huge for us, is SEO, organic search. It's been an incredible free traffic driver for us.
What did you do in the early days with SEO that allowed you guys to grow?
Invested a lot in content. So just blogging, creating content, talking, you know, kind of like what you're talking about, but more inward looking than outward looking. Talking about tickets, events, tours, trying to provide stuff that people are interested in reading about.
Give me some examples. What are some articles that did well for you for an SEO, or types of articles?
So, you know, over the last 5 or 6 years, we've seen music festivals totally blow up, and they've become a whole new category, in their own right. And we've noticed that speculation around who's going to be in various lineups for music festivals is it's almost like a little cottage industry. Like people are sort of obsessed with this stuff and want to read about it and talk about it. So we, you know, we've done a lot of content around sort of analyzing who might be in those lineups when the news breaks, breaking it as quickly as we can, you know, ranking as well as we can, providing data around like, okay, you know, you're going to see all these people, and if you saw them all individually, it would cost this much, and we have that data. But, you know, you can actually see them for this much less. So look at the kind of deal you're getting. So, you know, that kind of stuff that hopefully creatively uses the data we have to look at things with a different spin. Another example is, you know, during the Home Run Derby every year, we'll do analysis of like, okay, given what we know statistically about where people hit home run balls, and also given we know what we know about where what ticket prices are in all of those various sections, where do you get like the best bang for your buck catching home runs?
I see. And so is SimilarWeb, that's what I use to keep track of traffic. I remember last time I used Compete, and Russ said, actually, your numbers are not accurate. So let me see if my numbers are accurate right now. It seems, according to SimilarWeb, that you guys are getting roughly 50% of your traffic from organic search.
So the honest answer is I don't know exactly. We don't disclose traffic stats. So much of our traffic these days comes via our mobile app that I think anything that looks, you know.
But I mean, on the web, it looks like a large part of your traffic. Even if we can't say specifically that it's 50%, is it fair to say that a large part of your traffic is coming from search, from people?
Yeah, it's not that high, but it's certainly meaningful. It's probably, you know, 30% or something like that.
And is it mostly these blog posts, or are we also looking at each one of these events has its own page on your site, and as a result, that gets searched too?
Yeah, so increasingly, as we've gotten a little bit bigger, it's become more and more the latter, although the former really supports the latter, and the two link to each other.
What about PR? You guys seem to still be good at PR. I think we were reintroduced from a company called Haymaker.co. That's a PR company?
Yeah, we work with – they're great. A small firm here in New York that we've known for a while.
What's your goal with PR, with being on Mixergy, for example?
Question. You know, a lot of the PR we do is really trying to sort of authentically just communicate who we are. I think ticketing is this industry that it's almost like cable companies or the airlines. One of the industries that's, you know, full of a lot of animosity towards some of the bigger players. And, you know, if you walk around our office, we're just a bunch of, you know, makers, engineers who like to build stuff and like to go see shows and games and pretty authentic, good people, I think. And we hope that we can use, you know, PR communications to sort of express that, authentically talk about who we are. Because really, we're our users, we're fans just like everyone else. We just happen to have dedicated our lives to, you know, building software to enable people to go to more stuff.
What is the issue with that? So I understand the problem with Ticketmaster, and I had the former CEO of Ticketmaster on, Sean Moriarty, and he talked about, yeah, here's why people don't like us, and he gave his point of view on it. But I don't understand why a site like yours, a marketplace, people would have an issue with. Is it because you guys are driving prices up by making tickets more available?
Yeah, so I would say people don't have an issue with it. I think our brand is really strong. It's more using PR communications to really, in a lot of ways, in ourselves as a foil to that, right? To say like, okay, you know, you may think of legacy companies as X and help people understand why we're radically different, why we're, you know, altogether new and different and on your side and here fighting for you.
I see. All right. So PR, search, and then is there a third thing that helped you guys grow? Do you do a lot of ad buys?
Later, but early on, we, you know, very lean, like didn't do much in terms of buying ads. Another thing we did that was cost effective, and I think hopefully it was a win-win for the people we worked with, was did a lot of biz dev partnerships with content sites. So I'll give you an example of one of the ones that we're most proud of. I had a long-standing deal with Yahoo Sports, which is the biggest sports on the internet, where we power ticketing for all of Yahoo Sports. So, you know, imagine a sports site, you go throughout their schedules page, for example, and you'll see a stats link, and you'll see a news link, and for each game, you'll also see a tickets link. And on Yahoo, that goes to SeatGeek, and we've worked with the team there to integrate it in lots of different ways. So the idea is that, you know, we're actually adding value for them, right? Because, you know, if we're doing our job, we're giving their users a way to buy stuff quickly and efficiently, and they're obviously generating traffic for us. So we, you know, constructed that as a win-win early on. We've been partners with them since 2010, We've done similar deals like that over the years.
Yeah, that was one of the early ones when you guys were just getting started. And because it was Russell, I think, who had a friend or a connection at Yahoo who was going to nurture your relationship and do more than he should have been expected to do. I get that. I get that someone's pulling for a new entrepreneur and working with them. What did you do after that? What other partnerships were you able to get that worked?
More recently, I have a deal with Living Social, which I guess is very soon going to be part of Groupon. But similar idea there, right? Where, you know, events are a source of content for them that they push out to users when we see really good deals on stuff. And we've, you know, driven a lot of sales for them.
I see you guys are also buying Google Ads on search results.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, so I'm not, you know.
But that's just a tough market to compete in because everybody is. All of your competitors are doing the same thing. Hamilton, New York tickets, every single ticketing company seems to be bidding on that.
Yeah, but ultimately what we're betting on there is that we're going to provide a better experience and that you're going to come back. So everyone's – you're right. There's a ton of people bidding on that. I'm extremely biased. I would argue that we are more invested in creating a great user experience for you than anyone else on earth. And if we deliver on that, that you're going to use us for life and that you're going to repeat and you're going to become hopefully a loyal SeatGeek user so that, yeah, we're willing to pay the first time because we believe in the product and we believe in what we do and we believe we have the best thing out there. And we deliver on that, then we pay for you the first time, but after that, we don't.
So you mentioned earlier, if I look at the web traffic, I'm not really getting a good picture because it's mobile app specifically. What was the decision like to get a mobile app together internally?
Yeah, it was much debated. Because a lot of people, you know, this was back in like 2012, 2013, a lot of people thought it was just going to be a distraction, like we had enough to worry about. You know, God forbid we build a mobile app. God, that's the last thing we need.
But this was like 5 years after the iPhone came out that you guys were thinking about, and there was still internal debate.
Yeah, but maybe, I guess, you know, time moves quickly. Back then, it was not an obvious decision. Most, you know, sort of peer companies did not have one. You're right. Today, that seems like a ridiculous thing to even say, but back then it was not obvious, at least to me. Maybe I was just being slow.
Okay.
We eventually, you know, decided to do it, sort of thought about it almost as if it was, you know, back then browser support was an issue. So right now, you know, thanks to web standards, you don't have to worry too much about like building for Internet Explorer versus Firefox, et cetera. Back then you did. Mm-hmm. And we almost thought about it as like another browser that we had to support where there was enough traffic flowing through native mobile that if we didn't support it, we were just sort of shutting off a big fraction of the internet to SeatGeek in a way that was unacceptable. So we had to support it.
So you guys decided, let's do it. How committed or what did you guys create as a first version? Facebook famously just did HTML5, right? Even Google, actually, the first version of Gmail they used to have was just a wrapper around their basic website for Gmail. What did you guys do the first time?
We invested a lot of time in it. We built something that was native to iOS. It was feature poor, so it was a very streamlined e-commerce experience. You couldn't do much in it besides look up an event and buy tickets to it.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the e-commerce part didn't happen within the app. So we were talking earlier about how we used to link people out to third-party sites to purchase. This was back when we did that, so we didn't have to build checkout within the app. So when you would load it up, it would just be a big-ass search bar right in the middle of the page, and that was all there is. You'd search for what you wanted. That part was easy. The hard part, and this part that we invested 90% of the time on, was building an interactive stadium map, so almost like a little mini version of a Google Maps map within a native iOS app. Mm-hmm. Which is a core feature of our desktop site and something we'd invested a lot of time on, but transporting that to mobile was hard.
Talking about, tell me if I'm understanding you right. When I go to StubHub to find Hamilton tickets, for example, I see a row of tickets with prices and dates. When I come to SeatGeek, I see a row on the left side of my screen, but the main part is the actual theater's outline. And when I mouse over any one of the tickets, the seat in the theater kind of lights up to let me know where I'm sitting. That's what you're talking about. And that's what you needed to create for the mobile app too.
Yeah. Exactly. And, you know, that was a really fun UI challenge, right? Because you couldn't just literally copy it. We had to think about, okay, you know, given that the user doesn't have a mouse, how does that translate? And given that the screen is oriented differently, how does that translate?
You know what? So we had to I wonder about that. So, like, I actually don't know. I've got the app right here, of course.
Yeah.
I can't make it light up, right? If I tap on a ticket, I can't. Oh, I know what I can see, though. I can see the perspective of the stadium from that seat.
Yeah.
Got it. I see. But I have to tap on it. I can't see it unless I click over. Got it. And that's the limitation of no highlight, no mouse over.
Well, but one choice we made is that by default on mobile, when you load up an event, the first ticket in the list is active. And then as you scroll the list on the bottom,
right.
that's a very specific thing we did for mobile because, you know, the mouse doesn't exist, right?
I see. So as I scroll up, new ticket gets highlighted on the list, and the seat is highlighted on the map that's above the list. I see. And all that you guys had to do. And then how soon after you launched did it take off and become a success?
Pretty quickly.
Okay.
It was pretty clear early on that we were onto something bigger than we realized. You know, at the time, I think we thought about it as an experiment that we hoped would work, but I think a lot of people at SeatGeek didn't see us as the future of the company as being mobile, and it became pretty quickly that that was the case.
How did you get people to download the app?
It was promoted pretty heavily by Apple early on, which mm-hmm. helped a lot. And I'd like to think that it was because we invested a ton of time in building something really great.
Okay.
So that helped. You know, we another thing that really helped was that, you know, again, maybe time was quickly, but back then, 2012 or so, mobile e-commerce was very nascent. And because of that, paid media for buying, you know, installs, on platforms like Facebook were still super cheap. And no one had really figured out how to monetize that yet. So we were able to get really efficient traction that way as well.
You know what I wonder is this, that I get installing an app for email. I go to email every day. I get installing an app for my doctors. I'm with One Medical. I freaking love that I have an app that I can just communicate with the doctor and not have to go in. Because I do that maybe once a month. But for tickets, I might need a ticket 4 times a year. Why install an app for something that I do so rarely? Why shouldn't I just go to the website?
Yeah, so on one hand, it depends how often you do it, right? So our users on average buy tickets 8 or 9 times a year. Some people more, some people less.
Okay.
But the other big thing, and this is really comes down, it's a technology issue, is that we and anyone else can still deliver a better experience in a native app. And that could down to hardware acceleration, the limitations of JavaScript, and other things like that. But we can fundamentally deliver a smoother mapping experience. We can use notifications. We can use Apple Pay. There's things that are simply not possible in the mobile web that are possible natively.
Okay. But then you still have to communicate that to a user who just wants to buy a ticket. How do you do that?
How do we communicate that it's worth downloading the
app? Yeah, exactly. I might just go to the website, and I know I can use a website on its own, but why would I want to go and install it? How do you communicate to me that I should?
Yeah, it's a product marketing challenge. I mean, I think it's incumbent on us to, and there's lots of little ways you can do that, to tell people, you know, basically why it's worth it. I'll give you one pretty compelling example is, let's say you and I are going to a LA Dodgers game together, mm-hmm. and let's say I bought the tickets, and I want to transfer one to you using the SeatGeek app. I would do that, and I would send it to you within SeatGeek. You're going to get that ticket, and you're going to want that with like 100% certainty, right? You don't have to want to load up a page to maybe get it. You want it freaking on your phone when you show up at the gate. That's only going to be possible if you have the native app. And as a result, we're going to like lead you into a flow that when Jack transfers you a ticket, you know, leads to you getting the native app. So yeah, it's selfish because we want you to have the app, but it's also really for your own good. It's because when we show up at Dodger Stadium, we want to make sure you get in for sure.
Okay. And then what percentage now of your sales are done through the app as opposed to the web?
I think it's about 70% through the app.
Wow. And how much of your traffic is on the app versus, or the users are on the app versus the web?
I don't know exactly. I think it's around 70% as well.
Wow. And you guys have, where is that? Oh, come on. My browser's frozen. But you guys have a lot of web traffic too. There it is. Monthly visits, according to SimilarWeb, 3.3 million, 3.4 million. Huge. Wow. All right. I got to tell people about the second sponsor. You think if I read enough of these sponsorship messages, I can get as big as you guys, or should I get the hell out of this business? What the hell? Look at this. The amount of growth you guys have had in the last 6 years is unreal. And it's because of little distinctions that you keep on making throughout. How's your personal life changed because of this? Because the company now is doing so well.
Probably less of one.
Really? How many hours a week are you working now, or a day?
Probably easy to think about on a per week basis. Probably about 80, I would guess.
80 hours. So typical day, you wake up at what time?
7.
7 o'clock. And do you do anything before getting to work that's meaningful?
I mean, it's some days I'll go straight to work. Some days I wake up at 6 and work out.
Work out. Okay. Then you get to work. What's the first thing you do at work?
Email.
And you do it yourself?
Oh, yeah.
You do?
Of course.
Really? I get so many emails. My assistant goes through the first pass, and then I get on a call with her, and we do it together.
Oh. You do email together?
Sorry?
You do email together?
Together. I can't sit and do it by myself, so we'll do a screen share, and then we'll go through email, and then if I have any questions about something, she might fill me in, and if there's something that I think that I got it, I can make a decision on, but there needs to be more work. Like, I'll give you an example. One of my past guests wanted me to do a $1 purchase on Kickstarter. It's a guest, a friend of mine, right? She doesn't know whether I should do it or not. I get it. Andrea, can you please just go and do this $1 campaign? So she'll do it, and then I'll move on to the next email. That kind of thing really helps a lot. Plus, having a monitor, somebody there watching, is helpful.
Huh. Interesting. Does she respond as you?
No, never. And very clearly, she at the top of the email says, "This is Andrea, Andrew's assistant. I think I can handle this for you." I've seen a few people who respond on behalf of a few assistants who respond on behalf of the person. I think it's a little weird if it's not them. But I learned this from Drew Houston. I used to email Drew, and I could just get Drew emailing me right back. Then one day I emailed his personal email address, and his assistant emailed me back. And I said, "How did you do that?" Turns out there's a delegation feature in Gmail. So I go, "All right, let's try that." Yeah.
I got to look into that. I like
yeah.
That.
You end your day typically at what time?
Varies a ton. Between 7 and 11.
Do you have any little productivity tips like that that you do? Like the one where I have my assistant answer my email and then do it with me?
I really like gamifying my to-do list. So I keep like a pretty meticulous to-do list. Attach a priority to each thing, expected number of minutes, and then I've basically written a little bit of code to sort of track when I start and end each task.
Really?
And how long it takes to do each thing, and then almost treat it like a game where I'll sort of allocate how many minutes I have to do something, how many it actually takes, and see if I can kind of beat the expected number.
Is there something that's like a regular part of your day that you do this for? Like email, for example. Do you time how long you spend on email?
So for email, I make it's almost like an exception, right? Because otherwise it can dominate your day. So I just have 3 30-minute blocks for email, and I try to not let myself do more than that.
I see. Interesting. You should try having an assistant look at your screen, see how much faster you work with someone looking over your shoulder.
How long do you spend on email?
It's hard to say. Today I spent only 35 minutes, and we got through 65 messages, maybe 70.
Wow.
But it's hard to predict because all it takes is like one person who emails me a big PDF that I need, a legal PDF that I need to go through, that then would add another 15 minutes to my day. Do you do anything at night before going to sleep that's useful?
Nothing particular. I've been meditating in the morning every day, which I love.
You do what? Meditate?
Meditating in the morning when I wake up every day.
How do you meditate? What's your process?
Just sitting in a chair silently. 10 minutes. Yeah.
10 minutes and an alarm will go off?
15. Yeah.
Wow. 15. Interesting. And it's not like transcendental meditation or any kind of specific format. It's just you sitting in a chair.
Mindfulness meditation.
How'd you learn how to do it?
I'm an executive coach I use who's been a very good teacher. I also just use a bunch of apps, read about it a bit. Went to a retreat once.
Who's the coach? Is it someone I know?
I don't think so. I'm not sure she'd...
Okay.
Let me get back to you on that.
And the retreat? Who's that?
I was just in New York at a meditation center here.
Okay. I went on a personal retreat to Ananda. I forget exactly where it is. It's like California, Nevada, somewhere around there in the mountains. I love it. Just going away and focusing on something is the best way to get good at it.
Awesome.
All right. TopTal is the company that I was going to talk about. Do you know TopTal?
No.
Great. I get to introduce you to TopTal. Here's what they are. They started out as this network of developers. They said, look, there are people who just don't want to work in Palo Alto. They don't want to work in Mountain View because they just don't want the commute. They don't want that lifestyle, but they're fan-freaking-tastic developers. So the founders of TopTal knew them and started creating this network of these great developers, and they hired them out. So if you needed a great developer, they'd ask you, how do you work? What are you working on? For example, for you guys years ago, maybe all your developers are working on the web, but you have this hunch that you should be building a web app, or excuse me, a mobile app. You go to TopTal, you say, look, I need a mobile app. It can't be a crappy mobile app. I need the best of the best because otherwise I'm going to get lost in the app store. It can't be bad because I have all this competition. And if I look bad in the first round, then no one's going to want to try me out. They'll just switch to the competition. So you talk to them about how you want to do it. Think it through. They bring you incredible, not just one developer in that case, a team of developers who will get you going, who work under your guidance or your CTO's guidance. And you get to vet every one of them, but basically they've done so much work ahead of time that most of the people they put in front of you, you're going to want to hire. Then you start working with them using whatever, what do you guys use? Slack to talk to your developers in your team? Slack, right? So you add them on Slack, you work with them like they're full-time in-house, boom, they finish the product, you launch it, you keep the ones that you want to work with after that. Maybe you want to hire the whole team, who knows? And you're good to go. That's the thing about TopTal. They've been used by companies like Airbnb and many other well-known companies that we know of. They expanded beyond development now to design. So you can hire designers this way. They expanded to finance. So if you wanted somebody to help organize your books in preparation for the next round of funding, you could do that. Anyway, here's where anyone who's listening to me can go check them out, including you guys at SeatGeek. If you want to hire from TopTal, get the best of the best, go to top as in top of the mountain, tal as in talent, TopTal.com/Mixergy, because when you go there, they're going to give you 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours. And that's in addition to a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. There's a reason they keep sponsoring here. It's because it's just working for them. People are hiring like mad from TopTal. And my guess is it's mostly interviewees, people like you who are sitting there going, I never heard of them. Tell them someone on my team. Go check them out. All right. By the way, why do you meditate? What do you get out of meditating?
Good question. I think it's a surprisingly difficult question to answer given how much I like it. I guess the classical answer is it helps you be better at being present, which I think is true. I think for people that aren't really into it, that seems kind of like froofy and silly. I don't know. I used to be very into like the social psychology literature of happiness and sort of what drives human happiness. Which, by the way, is one reason I'm so into live entertainment, because I think there's a lot of literature around, you know, live entertainment being a really high leverage way for, once you've reached sort of a sustenance level of income, being a really high leverage way to spend your money to engender human happiness. Another very high leverage way to spend your time to engender happiness is meditation and sort of the practice of being present.
Do you optimize for that? You optimize for happiness, not for productivity or for user base or money?
Well, I mean, it's sort of, you know, life optimization and seeking optimization. And I guess there may be sometimes at odds, but often consistent, right? So personally, I'm sort of optimizing for, for happiness and fulfillment and other things like that. I think in terms of how we run our company, SeatGeek is not run for Jack's happiness, right? It's run for very good things. So, and hopefully those things are consistent. You know, you have a good job.
What else do you do for happiness to make sure that you're enjoying your day?
I mean, I do think that the job you have is one of the, you know, most impactful things you can do, right? Spending a scary amount of time with the people you work with. And my favorite thing about SeatGeek is just our team.
But then you also have all these crises. It's fun to hang out with your team. It's fun to hang out with Russ at coffee shops thinking of big ideas. It sucks when something happens like what happened to you guys at the Super Bowl 2015. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Yeah, sure.
What happened there?
So this actually is an industry-wide thing where a little bit of context. There's something in the secondary market for tickets called spec selling, which is when a seller lists a ticket, which they do not yet have, sells that ticket on the promise that they'll deliver it later. And it's, for most events, highly discouraged. We don't allow it really for most events across the board. Super Bowl historically has been an exception, the reason being that nearly all Super Bowl tickets don't get released until the last minute. So there's really, it's not possible to require the seller have the ticket far in advance because they simply aren't out in the wild yet. So anyway, back in 2015, it was effectively a squeeze on the market where there were too many of these sales and simply not enough tickets to actually fulfill them. So then when, you know, a few days before the event, when it actually became time to fulfill them, a bunch of people went out to sort of fill the orders. There weren't enough tickets. Prices rose. Sellers had to break a lot of orders, meaning go to users and say, listen, I'm really sorry. Just don't have your tickets. I'll refund your money, but that's all I can do, which sucks from a user perspective. So SeatGeek, we were in a bit of an unusual perspective in that, as we were talking about earlier, we weren't actually the marketplace, right? We were actually just a lead gen to a third-party website. So theoretically, could have said, you know, to kind of wash your hands of it.
Theoretically, legally, could you have said that?
Yeah,
sure. You could. You could. It's not your issue. You guys are just referring out.
Yeah.
But,
you know, made the decision when we could to go to bat to the user to do whatever we could financially to buy tickets and fill the order. Ended up losing quite a bit of money. I don't remember exactly what it was, but a substantial amount of money for us at the time. But did it because we thought it was the right thing to do.
Wait, so somebody bought a ticket, didn't end up getting the ticket. You then paid for what? Would they have flown out to see the game?
In many cases, yeah.
They fly out. They don't have the ticket to see the game, but they're in the city. I forget what city that was in. And what do you guys pay for in that case?
What do we pay to get the ticket?
Did you buy them the ticket?
Yeah, so we would then.
You paid whatever you needed to get these guys the ticket because they made it out there. And so here's what I heard. If a ticket was selling for $2,000 on your site and somebody bought it for $2,000, you might have actually had to go and spend $20,000 to get that ticket for the person.
It would probably be more like 10, but yeah, that was the basic idea.
And you were willing to do that, and you just don't know how much money you lost. I've got here in my notes that you guys might have lost over $1 million on that.
I think it was quite that much, but it was a lot, yeah.
A lot of money. And your thinking was what on that?
That, you know, we owe it to our users that we ultimately have built the brand around standing up for our users, around user trust, and that even if it meant a meaningful financial loss, it was important that we kind of stand behind that.
And you can kind of do that because you've got funding. First of all, you got revenue, right? But second, you also have funding too. You guys raised, is this right? Is Crunchbase's $103 million roughly dollars? Is that right?
Yep.
How much of that did you guys use to just take money off the table and be a little safer in your personal lives?
No, we didn't do that.
It all went straight to the business.
We cleaned up our cap table a little bit in terms of earlier angels and that sort of thing.
I see.
But nearly all of that straight to the business.
And where does that go in the business? What's the big expense that you needed to raise money for?
All the classical stuff that you'd expect. So investing in the brand and marketing, building out our team, building out infrastructure. And, you know, a lot of it's still left, too. It's not like we spent all that. We see this as a very long-term journey that we're just still at the beginning of.
Is this right? Ashton Kutcher is an investor? Excel Partners investor? Eli Manning investor? Dreamit still have ownership of the business, or they still have equity in the business? Founder Collective? Am I missing anyone who's especially well known?
TCV is a large early investor.
Okay.
Or sorry, not early investor. They led our Series C.
Okay. So look at this. You didn't take any money off the table. You're freaking working 80 hours a week. When you do things like answer email, you don't just do them. You're actually timing yourself, which is a tremendous amount of pressure. You're coming back here 6 years after you guys were first on here, still doing promotion for the business by yourself on your own. What's the best part of having done all this? Because it seems like still a ton of work.
Yeah, but it's fun, right? Like, I think if you don't, yeah, it's work if you don't enjoy it. Otherwise, it's just.
What's the most fun of your day outside of like doing this interview, which has got to be number one?
Obviously, this is my way.
Yeah.
The most fun part of my day.
Yeah. Or your week or your job. Like, what's the part that you look on and you say, you know what? The kid who actually left Bain & Company would love that I get to do X. What's X?
Yeah. it's changed over time. I mean, I still love product stuff, or building things. I don't code at all anymore. I used to code quite a bit. But when I get to work with the guys and girls on a product team, I love that. As our company has gotten a bit bigger and we've gotten sort of better at, this is sort of a weird answer, but it's true. So we've gotten better at actually trying to like predict and operationalize our business and say like, okay, we're going to set out to do like these specific things over the next quarter. And this is like a,
yes,
10 megabyte Excel file that backs that up. And if we actually do that, that's very satisfying, right? To have the sort of a complex organization with a very complex business that we've modeled out and actually marshal, an increasingly larger organization towards a certain goal and we hit it. It's been a lot of fun. Another thing that's been a really cool learning experience for me is like for our first, 3 or 4 years as a company, we're really just purely a product company and so focused on just building great stuff, but very, very little focus put on finance, marketing, sales, sort of everything else. And a lot of the last few years for me have been trying to not, go from being a world-class product company to just being a world-class company, full stop. So learning a ton about all of those other areas and getting to learn from like experienced execs who are a lot more knowledgeable than me as we try to make SeatGeek, world-class.
What did you learn about it, about taking care of the finance part or the sales part of the business that you didn't know that's incredibly valuable that we can pass on to the audience?
This is maybe an embarrassing thing to even say, but I'd say early on in our history, I had a lot of skepticism and avoidance of budgeting and sort of the formality of financial planning, and thought that was just like an annoyance that I didn't want to deal with. As it's like part of the luxury and freedom of running startups, you have to deal with that kind of bullshit. Mm-hmm. So we got all, we'd raised over $100 million before we had our anyone running finance. I think we had one or two folks who had just joined in an accounting role, but that was it in terms of SeatGeek finance. I had a guy named Brad who joined a little over a year ago to run finance here and has sort of totally changed, really created the makeup of the finance org, because now we have a very complex model / budget for sort of the next year, the next 3 years, which is good in its own right. But the third part that's been really cool is that all of a sudden you're able to you have lever. You can sort of like think about what your P&L, you want your P&L to look like, and actually have levers to move and have a perspective on like how you want your business to look, and then actually go make it happen in a way that was just it was totally intangible before.
I see. It's like goal setting on a big level for finance.
Yeah, it's almost like the whole OKR framework. It's almost like OKR is sort of like this Googleism goal setting framework.
Okay.
Objectives and key results.
Okay.
So I bring it up because almost think about it, budgeting processes of like sort of have this business objective of profitability, and then you have all these key results of like different lines in the P&L that you can move in different ways to actually get there.
Do you think that would have helped you if you had this guy that we're talking about is Brad Tacey?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, a guy who used to work at, did finance for Spotify. Do you think if you had him for like a week, a year, maybe 3 years ago, that it would have helped you with planning? Or if he would have created this projection years ago for you on a regular basis, that would have helped? Or did you have to grow to this level before you can use that?
I don't think that would have helped, because I think he would have not been familiar enough with the business for him to have much to add.
I see.
I think it probably took him 4 or 5 months before he was at a place where he could begin to do that.
Got it. Okay. All right. Well, congratulations on having gotten this big. I'm looking forward to our next interview in about 5-6 years, where who knows how big you'll get. But it's inspiring, frankly, to see it, because I knew you guys when you were just getting going, when you were just making it into something that people said, what is that? Is that like Y Combinator, this thing? Mm-hmm. Right? They didn't know you. They didn't even know the people who invested in you. And then now everyone seems to know about SeatGeek. And frankly, apart from them knowing this is something that you can't really put a number on or anything, the app just is fun to use. It just works so beautifully well. I love it. All right. Thanks so much for doing this. Thank you all for being a part of it. We've obviously been talking about SeatGeek. You can go to the website, but you probably are going to want the app instead. So go to the app. Oh, wait. I forgot to talk about the one thing. Sorry. SeatGeek Open, the future.
Future.
Right. The thing that I botched in the intro where I said it's a radically open approach to ticket sales by a venue. That was the one sentence I had to read, and I still got it wrong. I think your description of it is better. What are you trying to do with that?
Yes. Yeah, it's a whole really new part of the business we launched earlier this year. So, you know, sort of classic SeatGeek is a B2C app, and SeatGeek Open is for venues and teams and artists, promoters, and it allows them to run their business better and reach more fans. So the idea is, let's say that you run Dodger Stadium, and historically maybe you've worked with a legacy ticketing company like Ticketmaster, mm-hmm. and that ticket company has only allowed you to sell through one single channel.
Which is what, Ticketmaster.com?
Exactly. Might not be the most popular channel on the internet. Might not be the best mobile experience on the internet. I'll leave that up to you.
There aren't a lot of people who are installing the Ticketmaster app the way that they're installing SeatGeek, or just browsing the app the way that they would browse other apps, for example.
And, you know, even if it was the best experience, not even the biggest, it's very atypical in an e-commerce setting to have mono-channel distribution, right? Not even Apple only allows, you know, only sells through Apple.com. They sell through the whole internet. It just makes freaking sense. So SeatGeek Open allows venues and teams to run their business by selling tickets across the whole web on any ticket site, but also on any other e-commerce site on a physical location to reach users where they are across the whole web. That user data then flows back to the team so that they can ultimately create better experiences for fans.
Meaning that if I buy a ticket, they'll know my name and how to contact me so that they have a relationship with me. They don't do that with Ticketmaster?
No. In some cases, they'll have that information, but usually they won't. So when we go out and talk to teams, a very common complaint, maybe the most common complaint, is that the team does not know who's in their venue. And there's all sorts of implications from that, from a marketing, you know, concern, but also even a security concern about, you know, not knowing who's actually attending your events.
I see. So I understand that sports teams can do that, but like other venues can't because they're so tied into Ticketmaster, right? They've got long-term relationships with them.
Yeah. So this is, give you an example. We're going live with our first team, Sporting Kansas City, early next year, and that's replacing Ticketmaster, which was previously ticketing that venue. So this is a long-term deal that usually would be replacing another ticketing system within a venue.
Yeah, so this got to be a real long-term bet for you guys. It's not the kind of thing that can take off in a year even. Am I right?
Yeah, totally. It's us investing over the long-term, but it's because I think there's a huge need for this, and because there's just a ton of opportunity. And because teams are so frustrated, venues are so frustrated, artists want to reach their fans, they want to create better experiences, and the rails just don't exist. You know, like the technology doesn't exist to enable that.
You know what? I've heard so many entrepreneurs talk to venues because they want to get their software in venues in front of thousands of people. And the one thing that resonates with venues, like, yeah, it's nice if you can do this, it's nice if you can do that, but can you tell us who's here? I want to be able to contact them. That always seems to be the big winner. So if you have like a bot, for example, and you want a venue to use the bot, don't sell them on all the things that it could do. Sell them on the one thing that they want, which is they'll know who's in their stadium. That's huge. All right. And so you guys are doing that among other things. And we'll just keep watching SeatGeek Open as it develops. And of course, SeatGeek, the app, is available for us right now. And the two sponsors that I mentioned are the first company will actually help grow your sales really in an organized way. Check out pipedrive.com/Mixergy. The second one will help you hire a great developer or designer or even someone to do the finances for your company. It's called toptal.com/Mixergy. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Bet. Bye, everyone.